This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If the banks are so darn healthy, how come it seems like they're still so darn broke? Despite billions in new profits, there is a report today that the government is trying to sweeten the bailout. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 20th of April, and I think you could fairly say today that the banking rally has run its course, at least for the short term. Bank of America joined the financial earnings parade this morning. It reported better than $2 billion in profit last quarter. But as was the case with some of its peers last week, worries over B of A's loan losses to come took a little life out of that announcement. And not helping at all was a story in the New York Times today that the Treasury Department is thinking about changing the terms of the investment it made in the big Wall Street banks as part of the bailout package. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is here to explain what might be happening and why. Hey, John.
Hello, Kai.
So, John, according to the Times, what the Treasury Department is going to do is change its preferred shares that it has now as a result of the bailout into common stock, right?
That's right. You know, the government's rescue fund is almost all committed and spoken for now. There's only a little more than $100 billion left of the original $700 billion, and Congress is in no mood to approve more, anytime soon anyway. So by converting the government's investments into common stock, that relieves the banks of having to pay 5% dividends to the government, and it beefs up a certain type of capital that banks can use as a shock absorber against future losses. So it's a way for the government to give banks a bit more of a benefit for the same amount of money. But, and I'm sure you knew there was...
And you knew there would be one. Yeah, go ahead.
You're right. Common shares are voting shares. The government can easily become the biggest shareholder of some banks and decide who's going to be on the board. It'll influence other decisions, business decisions, not to mention the potential conflicts of interest when the nation's lawmakers become big shareholders of a company.
Yeah.
Buying common shares is much closer to nationalizing the banks.
Just to be clear, John, though, it's not new money, right? They're not getting fresh capital.
It's exactly the same amount of money. It's accounted for differently. It becomes tangible common equity, which some accountants use as a measure of the ability of a bank to weather a downturn.
Well, and speaking of which, we're about to get in a couple of weeks the results of these stress tests that the Treasury Department has been doing, the tests of how well banks can weather a more prolonged downturn, right? What does this move, this potential move, say about the possible results of those tests when they come out in 2 weeks or so?
I put that question to Jeff Davis. He researches banks for the Howe Barnes brokerage firm. And he says that the fact that the government is considering doing this is not good news for the banks.
It implies the government believes that down the road, not this quarter or second quarter, but later this year into 2010, loan losses are going to be significantly higher than what investors expect. Therefore, the banks are going to need more common equity to absorb losses than what they have today.
Okay, well, as one of those investors now, John, right, since I'm a taxpayer in this country.
That's right.
What does this do for the risk that taxpayers are taking with the bailout?
Well, there's no guaranteed return with common stocks, and there are no dividends. Taxpayers are not at the head of the line to be paid back. There is more of an upside potential if banks turn around, and that would be good for government revenue and the taxpayers, but that dilutes the returns for private common share investors, which is why the banks that have the ability will try to, as soon as possible, get out from under the government investments. Jeff Davis thinks that in the near future, some of the stronger banks, perhaps Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, BB&T Bank, will raise private capital, buy back the government investments, and that would be good for them, Davis says, but not for others.
The government's going to be left with wards of the state or quasi-zombies. And the J.P. Morgans and the BBTs are saying, in effect, we don't want to be part of that crowd.
Yeah, and of course, the next big battle is whether or not the banks are even going to be allowed to repay that TARP money, right?
Exactly. That's a big question.
John Dimsdale, our Washington bureau chief on the story for us. Thank you, John.
You're welcome, Kai.
On the topic of the government spending money, President Obama is looking for ways to save. He convened his first formal cabinet meeting today. Belt tightening was agenda item one. Department heads were told to look for ways to cut $100 million out of the federal budget in the next 90 days. On the theory that every last penny counts, everything from office supplies to offices are on the table, as Jill Barshay reports.
The Homeland Security Department says it can save $3 million by firing consultants who create new logos. And the Veterans Affairs Department says it can save almost $18 million by canceling conferences and using video instead. But altogether, $100 million is just a drop in the $3 trillion budget.
And you can think of that as equivalent to about 15 minutes out of an entire year's worth of spending that the federal government does.
That's Diane Lim Rogers. She's the chief economist at the Concord Coalition, a nonpartisan group for balancing the budget. Lim Rogers says to really get anywhere, we're going to have to cut programs or raise taxes to reduce the deficit. Paul Light is a professor at New York University. He says most of today's cuts should have been done long ago.
Obama would be taking a dramatic step forward if he asked the federal government to restructure itself, as we're doing with General Motors and some of the banks. The federal government is long overdue for a major scrub down, and you could save billions upon billions if you just restructured the federal government to eliminate duplication and overlap.
Both Light and Lim Rogers say the jury's out on whether Obama's $100 million cut is the first of many to come or a trivial public relations campaign. I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Like just about every other business that depends on advertising, commercial radio is getting pummeled in this economy. Ad revenues were down 9% last year. So some commercial broadcasters are fine-tuning their business models. They're trying a strategy that would sound familiar to our listeners. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
Used to be you could tell you were at the low end of the radio spectrum when you heard people on the air asking for money. But public radio is getting some company from stations like
KSCO Radio.
Talk Radio KSCO in Santa Cruz is launching a plan to ask listeners on its website to give. KSCO owner Michael Zwirling does the asking.
We're not getting rich off it, but, you know, I'm not proud, and we're making more than if we didn't do it.
The Wall Street Journal reports that other commercial stations are considering asking listeners to pitch in. Radio and records editor Mike Stern says in exchange, listeners get premium content.
It's a matter of taking the content that the network has available and maximizing it and making it available directly to listeners for a subscription fee.
Marketing experts say the idea makes sense. Radio was struggling before the recession hit. But Arthur Cohen with the Public Radio Program Directors Association cautions commercial stations to take it slow. He says as nonprofits, public stations use the model because they have to.
Public radio has been spending years trying to figure out alternative models because it drives away listeners and is an interruption to the programming that we are trying to do.
But the old one has worked pretty well in a bad economy. While public radio's underwriting has been down, Cohen says many pledge drives have been breaking records. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
You can join the conversation about this story on our blog, The Scratch Pad. It's called, our homepage is called marketplace.org. At the corner of Wall Street and Broad today in Lower Manhattan, they weren't talking much, just selling. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. General Motors announced another 1,600 layoffs today, mostly white-collar workers as the company restructures itself to cut costs. Still, as bad as things are here, GM is expecting to increase its sales in a key overseas market. That would be the alternative economic universe known as China, where the economy is still growing at better than 6%. The Shanghai International Auto Show opened today, and Marketplace's Scott Tong was there. Get up! What'd you
go? Get up! Shake up! World's auto brands rolled into China today, complete with live bands and acrobats and models in miniskirts and halter tops. Michael Dunn is with J.D. Power & Associates.
You see such a big turnout here. China is the center of the action for the auto market worldwide.
That's why Porsche picked Shanghai over New York to debut its new coupe. The Panamera goes for $90,000. Company executive Helmut Broker says China is the company's number three market, behind the U.S. and Germany.
We wanted to show the China community that we have received the message that they like Porsches, and we wanted to give them something back in their home market.
But the brand that's even hotter than Porsche here is GM's Buick. In China, American brands are considered high quality and durable. GM Vice President Nick Reilly vowed to protect the Buick brand as the company restructures.
Part of the reason is success in China. Although the U.S. government asked us to look at how many brands we should continue with, we have made it clear that we will maintain Buick, and they have now accepted that.
And automakers accept that the future is in smaller, greener cars.
Ford is committed to making our world a cleaner, greener place to live.
Ford is showing off a cleaner transmission technology called EcoBoost. GM and Toyota display plug-in hybrids. But Bill Russo of consultancy Synergistics is watching the Chinese competition. Most major Chinese brands at this show are displaying their own alternative energy vehicles, and they have the financial backing of Beijing.
China has more capacity to fund the next generation of development. When you know your opponent's the weakest is when you want to go on the offensive.
The Chinese government is also giving incentives to consumers. For the last 3 months, more new cars have sold here than in the U.S. At the Shanghai Auto Show, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Chances are pretty good that when you swing by the fruit and vegetable section of your local supermarket, the produce you're picking over came from California. The Central Valley here, running 400 miles up the middle of the state, produces a quarter of this country's food, thanks mostly to 80 years of cheap and reliable water. But California is in the middle of its worst drought in decades, and after three straight years of low rainfall, there is some worry that the Central Valley could become a dust bowl. So the state's $30 billion farming industry is changing, whether it wants to or not. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jennifer Collins reports.
If Fred Starr could farm anything in the world, it would be cotton. He grew the crop for more than 50 years, just a few miles outside of Bakersfield. He promoted the cotton trade abroad, and the dashboard of his car is covered in fluffy cotton plants.
So I've been a cotton guy all my life, and to have to quit at this time is really, you know, it's hard to do.
Cotton doesn't make as much as it did back in the 1950s. And because of the drought, it's more expensive to grow.
The economics, because of the water costs, have pretty much just priced us out of it.
Starr says the price he pays for water has doubled in just 3 years. So he and other farmers have to find ways to conserve water and still turn a profit.
If we want to keep a strong agricultural economy, we had better start thinking about how to do so as efficiently as possible.
Peter Glick studies how farmers can save water. He says the rising price of water can be a positive thing because farmers who pay a lot to irrigate their fields
tend to grow more water-efficient crops, and they tend to use more water-efficient technology to do so.
Glick says in just two decades, thirsty crops like cotton, alfalfa, and rice have been cut by a third in California's Central Valley. Much of that acreage now goes to planting fruits and nuts. They usually need less water and sell for more per pound. So now Fred Starr farms almond trees.
Where are we running water here on 31?
Starr's installed an irrigation system that targets water directly to the root of each tree, drop by drop.
Now, this is the dripper, you see, that's running right there right now. See it?
But there's a danger. When farmers cut back too much on these droplets, they risk damaging the trees permanently. Mike Young is the president of the county's Farm Bureau. He says some farmers grow plants that need just a few inches of rain, like dryland wheat or oats, but it's hard to make a living off of them.
When we're having to plant drought-resistant crops, usually that are lower economic value, it doesn't make business sense.
So growers are looking for crops that may use a little more water, but still save money. Young is harvesting pistachios for the first time this year. He's considered planting pomegranate trees, but he doesn't want to completely replant his fields, especially if all of his neighbors do the same thing.
If the whole state were to plant pistachios, pistachios aren't worth anything anymore. So, you know, you can only plant so much before you start to flood the market and make the crop go upside down.
Creating a market can take years. So in this drought, farmers like Starr ration their water using systems like this filtration ditch.
After the dirt sort of settled out, it pumps that back in and we reuse it.
So nothing's
lost.
And in a state that seems to grow drier every year, that's about all he can do. In Bakersfield, California, I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, the poetry of honest labor.
You know, I say to you, hey, do you know what work is? Sure. But do you really know what work is? Especially this kind of work. No, you don't know what it is.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the stress test on banks has Wall Street stressed. The Dow Industrials plummeted 289 points on this Monday. That's 3.5%. The blue chips finished at 7,841. Yes, that was a 7,000. The NASDAQ fell 64 points, 3.8%, closed at 1608. The S&P 500 dropped 37 points, 4.3% to end the day at 832. Fears about the government's economic stress test and impending earnings reports out this week led many investors to reconsider the value of financial stocks today. Bank of America plunged 24%. Citigroup fell 19%. Wells Fargo dropped 16% today. Insurer AIG lost more than 20%. PepsiCo spilled 4% of its value. That after announcing plans to buy out its two biggest bottling subsidiaries. London's FTSE lost 2.5%. The Paris CAC 40 and Frankfurt's DAX each dropped 4% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.84%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by DreamWorks Pictures, presenting The Soloist, starring Robert Downey Jr. and Jamie Foxx, in theaters everywhere April 24th. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing on regulating large financial institutions. The Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions discusses green skills training for workers. And a dietary conference focusing on some good carbs continues in Alexandria, Virginia. It's called Make at Least Half Your Grains Whole. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Today is a big day for the newspaper industry. The Pulitzer Prizes were announced this afternoon. And for the first time this year, the 92-year-old Pulitzer Board gave a nod to new media. The rules were expanded this year to include organizations that publish only online. No websites won in the end, but we had another thought. Given the newspaper industry's budget woes due in no small part to the rise of the web, do the Pulitzers matter as much as they used to? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story from New York.
Call the Pulitzer Prize office at Columbia University, and Administrator Sig Gisler will tell you that things aren't so bad.
I haven't taken a ruler to measure the length of entries, but there's still very substantial multi-part series. In fact, the watchdog function of journalism is very evident.
As for the number of entries this year, he says?
Down a little bit from last year, but just by a small amount.
But ask the people who know what it takes to win a Pulitzer Prize, and a different story emerges. Tom Fiedler, who's now the dean at Boston University's College of Communication, won two while reporting for the Miami Herald. He later became the paper's executive editor, so he knows firsthand how expensive it is to chase a Pulitzer.
It's such a gamble, for lack of a better word, that I think a lot of newspapers or those running those papers say, we just can't afford to take it.
Fiedler says being a winner can help readership, sort of like being the toothpaste dentists recommend can help toothpaste sales. Still, some editors are put off by the steep price tag.
It could well get close to, and I'm not exaggerating, $1 million. I know we spent $800,000 on one investigation looking into what happened after the 2000 presidential election.
Photographer Lucian Perkins got out while the getting was good. He took a buyout from the Washington Post 3 years ago after winning two Pulitzer Prizes for the paper. He says for many media organizations, aiming for a Pulitzer has taken a back seat to simply feeding the news beast.
They're not willing to have one reporter spend 2 weeks or a month investigating a really important story for the community when that reporter could go out every day and produce a mediocre story and be published 8 to 10 times and fill up the newspaper.
Do you think that you could have won your Pulitzer Prizes in this economic environment?
I think it'd be very difficult.
So, what's Perkins doing now? He's teamed up with 8 other photographers to investigate, as he puts it, the stories in America that newspapers are no longer willing to cover. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
April is National Poetry Month, so for the next couple of Mondays, we're going to be looking at and listening to the poetry of all things economic. Money and work, commerce and labor, almost anything you can attach a value to. Philip Levine grew up in industrial Detroit. He worked on the assembly lines at General Motors as a young man. His experiences there have fed a lifetime of writing about the blue-collar economy. And when we spoke, I asked him first to read one of his poems about not getting a job. So here's Philip Levine and What Work Is.
We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park. For work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision. Until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today," for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him? Held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek. You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No. Just because you don't know what work is.
You start this poem, second or third line, you say, you know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. And then you end with, because you don't know what work is. What does that mean? How do you make that transition from knowing to not knowing in the sense of this poem?
Ah, that's the poem. If you'd listened to the poem carefully, you'd know the answer. Yeah, you know what work is abstractly, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I say to you, hey, do you know what work is? Sure.
Yeah.
But do you really know what work is? Especially this kind of work.
Right.
No, you don't know what it is. It's not an abstraction for people working on the line, let me tell you.
What do you think of now when you read the problems that GM and Chrysler are having and then the problems that that is causing for all the folks who've been working for those companies for 35 or 40 years?
It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. I mean, because there was a myth, of course, that these companies could never perish and that their promises would be made good. And people bank. Now I'm an older guy, you know. I'm 81. And what would happen to me if I lost my pension from the California State University system and Social Security fell? I mean, I'd be out on the streets like these people might be.
What is it about good, solid, difficult blue-collar work that so resonates?
I suppose it's like reading about the Napoleonic campaigns. It's so far from most people's experience, that is, people who do a lot of reading. It has a reality to it. It has a power because of that. At the time I was doing it, I thought, this will prevent me from becoming a poet. I will never have the time or the energy to write poetry because it was sapping me to such a degree. And later on, when I was in my 40s, I realized, no, Phil, you know, that was the school you went to.
Hmm.
And my whole attitude toward those years changed. So there was a way in which I realized that I had had an irreplaceable experience of brotherhood and sisterhood in those years that I was an industrial worker, and I wouldn't give them up for anything.
Philip Levine, thanks very much for your time.
Well, thank you. Take care.
You can find more of my interview with Philip Levine on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, the latest entry in the They Spent the Bailout Money on What contest? General Motors revealed today that it spent almost $3 million lobbying Washington in the first quarter. That is pretty much exactly the time frame during which it was mostly surviving on $13.5 billion in government loans. The lobbying wasn't all bailout related, though. GM says it buttonholed lawmakers on everything from climate change to consumer safety. So there you have it. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 289 points, 3.5%. The NASDAQ lost 64 points, 3.8%. The S&P 500 dropped 37 points. That is 4.3% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, the service economy joins the recession.
If
things begin to turn around and people start sounding like they've got much more disposable income, that I will raise my fees too.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.